You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB the CV, copyright 2024, Proximo, Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Expressing your love can look many different ways. And with the right jewelry gift from Blue Nile, it can truly sparkle. Blue Nile's collection of classic diamond jewelry makes for the kind of gift that speaks volumes without saying a single word. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, Blue Nile's diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
The news is breaking now that Texas and Oklahoma have told the SEC, hey, we're coming. We are on our way, and we're fortunate here at Metalark Media. Our CEO started the Longhorn Network, the SEC Network, the ACC Network, and so he could walk us through the business of some of what it is that's happening here.
What's he doing with us?
It is a little bit curious. John Skipper is with us. So tell us what it is that's happening here. This is just a money grab, right? We've just realized that greed at the highest end right now is Texas and Oklahoma are saying, never mind about the history and tradition or anything. We got to go over there in that conference where they're splitting up a bunch of money that we don't get to split up over here.
Well, that is essentially correct. It's long ago gone away that anybody cares about geography or even really cares about rivalries, right? I mean, when Texas A&M fled to the SEC, they left behind their greatest rivalry because they wanted to get at the SEC money. This is just about trying to stay at the top of college football. College football drives enormous amount of contributions from alums. It drives prestige. It drives admission. It's really what drives the media rights deals is college football. And right now, Texas, which has one of the great brands, even though, as Jessica pointed out yesterday, it's been quite a while since they won anything, it's still arguably the biggest brand in football. There was a moment in time back in late 2010-11 where Texas was at the center of all college football, right? They were responsible for holding the Big 12 together, or they could have gone to the Big 10, which was trying to get them, or they could have gone to the Pac-12, where there was a plan to create a Pac-16 and a super conference. And the Longhorn Network is what kept them in the Big 12 and kept the Big 12 together.
And you built that Longhorn Network. I'm just sort of curious because you had this network that was bidding on the rights, but you also had a journalistic arm that was reporting on these details. I imagine when they're greasing the rails to leave, they're reaching out to a television partner. So you're hearing about it kind of first, and you have to report on that. And that's kind of an interesting position that you're in.
It is an interesting position, a potential conflict. You're dead on. And we handle it by keeping everybody except for me, the programming guys, worried about trying to buy the rights, the business guys tried to worry about making sure we still made the money. And at that instance, we decided that, by the way, Texas had decided to do a network. We didn't give them the idea, but we knew that if we did the network, we could entice them to stay in the Big 12, keep them together. That was important to us. We already had a Pac-12 deal, but the Fox was ascendant in the Pac-12, and we didn't want to see Texas go to the Pac-12.
Can you explain to us the dollars we're talking about here? Why is it, you were explaining to us yesterday in the other room, how many more millions are available here to Oklahoma and Texas now with this partnership than would be available to them otherwise?
Well, ultimately, it's easily $20 million, $30 million, $40 million. The gap will keep getting bigger because of the SEC network, which makes a lot of money, because of the new ESPN deal for the CBS game, which they paid over $300 million for. I can almost do the math. If there were 15 teams, not 16, that's $20 million per team. Eventually, Texas will get into that money.
$300 million for a game.
The Saturday afternoon game.
$300 million for one game. Compare that to where they were.
Well, at one point, the entire television deal for the Pac-12 right now, or the Big Ten, is about $300 million.
So that's for one game you're talking about. Yeah. That's why this is happening, right?
Yeah, that's the big 3:30 CBS game, which does as good a ratings as Thursday night NFL, right? They're doing 7, 8, 9.
Yeah, and as absurd as it sounds like, it seems as though ESPN got a crazy good deal because now Texas and Oklahoma come to the network. Is there any chances
I doubt that all of that is unrelated. I would not assume that this is just happening, that one day the Texas and Oklahoma guys woke up. I would guess that it's a logical sequence of events that they're now the ESPN has all of the SEC. Now they bring Texas and Oklahoma in. Think of all the good games you get. Yeah. Just think about Oklahoma and Auburn and Texas and
the potential postseason door that's been opened up with two separate conferences, a possible semifinal. $55 million is what CBS used to pay for that package, Dan.
But they get the best of the SEC matchups, which is incredible when you consider the teams that we were just discussing. But the Big 12 is done, John. So does that even matter in the grand scheme of things?
It certainly matters to Kansas State and Iowa State and those teams who now have to figure out what to do. Doesn't matter. I mean, there's tradition, but tradition's already been thrown away, right?
Yes.
So the Big 12 tradition is Frank Broyles and Daryl Royal and Texas, Arkansas. That doesn't exist anymore, right? All exists now is, can I get to the top of the pyramid? The Big 10 is there. The SEC is there. The ACC and Pac-12 will try to keep up. The Big 12 feels like it'll be a scramble now for who can find a home where.
And I think a lot of people think that the other conferences will also be scrambling now to try to consolidate either some of the Big 12 teams that are remaining or even AAC teams or Group of Five teams that might make them a bigger super conference, because it sounds like the way this is going is that in a few years, there might just be four super conferences, which was like this whole thing that's been around, kind of floating around in the ether for a while for college football fans, and Texas and Oklahoma kind of just started it, kind of saw into the future a little bit.
Well, there is some logic to having four 16-team conferences. It adds up to 64. There's a lot of impediments to it still, right? You'd like to start with a white sheet of paper and take the top 64 teams, but you can't. Right, you got some teams that are in there that are odd fits.
Rutgers.
Rutgers clearly is an interesting fit.
Big Ten would still tout the recruiting pipeline that opened up there. But from a prestige factor, you look at what's left of the Big 12, you'd probably say Kansas is one of the more appealing programs because of the basketball program. Does basketball matter at all when it comes to dollars and cents here?
With dollars and cents, basketball is about one-fifth, right? You're doing those conference deals into about 80% football, 20% basketball, with a possible exception of the ACC, where maybe it's more 65-35. So the ACC will be fine. Oddly enough, they wouldn't be a bad home for Kansas, though geographically it's crazy. Though it does bring in another state for the conference network, and that has to be kept in mind.
Why does that matter? Because people point out with Oklahoma that's a big deal.
Because if you add a college from a state you're already in, you don't get any more distributor fees, right? They add Texas. They've already got Texas A&M. There's no new money from the state of Texas. They add Oklahoma. They now have to pay a distribution fee in Oklahoma. If the ACC added Kansas, you'd have to add Kansas. And by the way, even with fairly small populations, it's still a lot of money for those networks, which all are above a dollar. So it's a dollar for every good citizen of the state who has a pay TV sub, which is declining, but still a lot of people. The other place for Kansas, of course, is to go to Big Ten, and it would make no difference for their football. They would lose the same amount of games they lose now. The harder part, too, is the schools can't kick anybody out, right? Now, that would be the ultimate sort of difficulty, which is, I'm not even going to say names.
Can we kick out? Are you talking about like in the SEC? You're talking about
Vanderbilt?
Vanderbilt's bringing up that GPA by itself. That's why Vandy is there.
I don't know. Clark Lee also.
They are. I had a son who went to Vanderbilt. I must tell you, it was not always pleasant to look into the Vanderbilt Stadium and see it full of Alabama fans.
But what is legitimately to keep the SEC from saying, you know what, get out of here, Vanderbilt, we want Ohio State?
Nothing.
It's a good question.
They should do it.
I think there may be some governance things. I'm not sure they could do it without everybody agreeing, the schools agreeing. It's an issue phenomenon which I don't think has ever happened.
I also don't think that schools can, or conferences can recruit schools to join them. I think the schools have to initiate the move, because that's kind of what's happening with the Texas and Oklahoma thing right now. The SEC can't admit.
Yeah, but everyone's noticing that this is what's the play here.
Right, like, no, I understand. But if you're Texas A&M and the SEC is violating your agreement and going out and recruiting your in-state rival, then you're going to have a problem with that. But the SEC can kind of play
none
dumb
of that
and
would
say,
happen in the dirtiness
they can kind of
business.
Play dumb and be like, Texas reached out to us and it makes sense. So here we are.
I doubt that Texas A&M has an agreement that they can't bring in another Texas school. This is a lot like dating in high school, right? It's not clear who asks whom when the prom comes around. Usually there's a way for somebody to make sure that Evelyn knows that Billy or Jane wants to take him or her to the prom. Somehow they figure it out. So I don't think Texas had to be asked, or Texas had to ask.
What are the money issues that you think the audience would find interesting here? You have a working knowledge that we don't have here about the money that's involved here and what this play will mean for 10 years from now.
Well, it just means that the bigger schools are going to get bigger. It's going to be harder to intrude into the club. Somebody yesterday said on the air there's 15 to 20 schools that overwhelmingly dominate college football. It's not even that many, right? If you look at the four who get into the playoffs, it's Clemson, it's Alabama, it's
and Notre
LSU.
Dame, yeah.
Ohio State.
Notre Dame has to be taken to the slaughter. I know we've got a fan here. Has to be taken to the slaughter every now and then.
They covered, but yeah.
They're one of the most interesting players here because they do have the choice. They value, and it's been great for them, their independence. But they do have to be careful that it's not musical chairs and that everybody doesn't get into a 16-team conference and they're the last one standing. And the ACC, on the other hand, has to worry not to give away the 15th and 16th spot in case Notre Dame became available. It was one of the benefits of COVID for them is suddenly Notre Dame was an ACC school for a year.
And the TV partners definitely benefited from that, considering how they game the system so Notre Dame could find their way into that championship game. I'm going to ask you a question, and please don't laugh at me, because you mentioned the ACC.
Undefeated.
Yeah, but you had Clemson at home. Back
they were undefeated.
Oh, okay. So were you. Jeez.
So how much does academics matter? Because with the ACC, we've read in the past that West Virginia would actually make a lot of sense for them, but they don't meet the academic standard. And this would be a hurdle in maybe making an overture to a UCF, which is actually a really attractive school, not just because their football program has gained notoriety, but they have the biggest alumni base in Florida. It's a diamond in the middle of the state right now to be had, but their academic standards aren't ACC standard.
It's interesting, Mike. I mean, it matters to some schools, right? Doesn't matter to other schools. Duke and Wake Forest and North Carolina and Virginia are going to want to have that. That was why they had a problem with West Virginia last time and didn't want to take them. In the Big Ten, you've got Michigan and Ohio State, and they really care. I forget what their There's a standard for schools that are in a certain association that the Big Ten is very proud of and has never taken anybody who wasn't in that. Oklahoma, whatever it is, Oklahoma State's not in. And I don't think Baylor's in. So they have a problem. And on the West Coast, Berkeley cares. And there's a, you know, UCLA cares and USC cares.
Stanford, yeah.
Stanford cares.
Can the money get to a place where they stop caring?
Apparently so, yes. I do believe in almost all matters of the heart, soul, mind, enough money can tend to overcome an issue.
So is Clemson better off in the ACC? I want every team now moving to the SEC, or should they consider a move to the SEC?
Clemson should be very happy to be in the ACC. They got an easier path to a football championship, which is what they care about. Every year would do nothing for the SEC because they already have a South Carolina school.
Right.
Now, interestingly enough, a North Carolina school would be very valuable to the SEC because the North Carolina is the ninth largest state in the country in terms of population. Little known fact from a Tar Heel.
You want your Tar Heel?
No, I do not want. No, no, I do not want.
They can go.
No, it would make the basketball would become easier, but no, you would want to not. You have to be in the same conference as Duke because you got to play them in basketball.
What's this all going to look like in 10 years?
It's gonna be super conferences, and it's going to be more and more concentration at the top. There is one interesting thing, just to create a little fun here, which is, in fact, the basketball tournament is an interesting thing, too. If you created four 16-team super conferences, the basketball conferences play in the NCAA tournament by choice. There is nothing that would prevent a breakaway basketball tournament.
Oh, wow.
I think there's also some people who think that this four super conference thing in college football could mean that the college football programs break away from the NCAA as well and kind of form a minor league college football program, I guess, with college affiliations.
I think that's right, Jessica, and that was why I was sort of suggesting that one way to gin up a whole bunch more money is, we're going to have a new basketball tournament, and if 64 teams works naturally, that all 64 teams could come into the tournament, one would play 64. So all of the super conference teams would make the tournament, and the current tournament with some independents and other conferences
would fall apart, would be irrelevant.
It would become the what's the second tournament?
The NIT.
NIT.
Could the schools just do this at any time? Could all the Florida schools just band together and be like, we're going to make a Florida conference? Imagine the TV deal we'd get that way.
No, I don't. I mean, I think that the schools have binding agreements that are tied to the TV agreements. So if the SEC agreements through 36 or 35 and the ACC agreements through 36, they cannot leave without negotiating an exit, which is one reason that Oklahoma and Texas are moving now, is the Big 12 contract is coming up. So it's within the amount of money they can negotiate that they're going to negotiate an exit from the Big 12. So it'll probably happen earlier than 25 or 26.
But do any of the schools have a binding agreement with the NCAA as the governing body who gets to give them the rules, but they don't obviously have anything to do with the college football playoff as it is right now?
I do not think. I think that the NCAA oversight does not have anything that binds the schools to actually do it if they don't want to.
Just to be clear then, John, the reason that this is happening is because the SEC will split up more money, and this will mean for Texas and Oklahoma in the short term, as soon as they join, somewhere between $20 to $40 million a year more than they're getting from their conference now. There's no whatever second place on the reason for doing this is a distant second. The reason.
That's correct. I mean, remember the one when Maryland actually exposed the numbers, right? The president of Maryland, whose name was Wallace something, I forget what, who'd previously been a president at Big Ten school, decided to join the Big Ten, and he just said his money. In X number of years, we're going to be getting 45. I think they're actually getting 55 now. We're currently getting 25 with that $20 million. We can make a great great new stadium. I'm not sure that's happened. And we'll become a football power. I'm not sure that's happened either. But it's just the pressure. It's the pressure to keep up with the big schools.
Is name, image, and license and likeness going to be something that creates more parity or less parity?
I think, like all instances, when things happen, there are a few people who think, oh my gosh, this will be great for the little guy. It's never good for the little guy. It'll be good for the big guys. One of the reasons, I suspect it's a minor reason, but Texas and Oklahoma are going to have to keep up. There's an Alabama quarterback who's getting $1 million already to play for Alabama. You're going to get more money in the SEC because they care more about it. Your ratings are higher. Well, the teams you play, the athletes are going to get more money. So the image and likeness just drive people back again to Clemson, Alabama, Texas, Oklahoma, et cetera, et cetera.
What about the medium to tall guy? Not so much the little guy. Someone that's right around 5'11", would have gotten to 6 if it were not for a flag in the Fiesta Bowl. Uh-huh.
Like me. Uh-huh.
Wait, first of all, there is no such thing as a 5'11 man. Just be real. There's after about 5'9", everybody's 6. Right? You start at 6. I'm 6'2 and 5'8". I think I'm shorter than Mike. But
Mike is living that lie with his Miami program.
No, it's not true. I believe Mike tells the truth.
Yeah.
But I do see a lot of guys who are 6'4 who are shorter than I am. I don't know what phenomenon that is.
Miami didn't get to 6, but if there's ever an argument for 5'12", it's FESable.
Are we going to see UCF ever?
Never.
Ever in this playoff? Is UCF ever going to get in this game?
I think it's pretty hard, right? These things are like weird college clubs, you know, skull and bones. You don't quite, you know, getting in is a hard thing. I don't think any of these schools want to see another superpower.
They don't want to be in it, Dan. They like occupying their little piece of real estate. Is, oh, if we played, we would have whooped you. Right. Everyone's so unfair to us.
It's a good
yet,
good space.
Look, anytime it comes to scheduling a game, they're like, okay, home, and away. Home, and away.
Please stop crucifying UCF.
No, he's right.
Okay,
they prefer the illusion of, hey, maybe they could win this game.
It's the only space for them based on the way they've just been boxed out by the superpowers all getting together and forming a monopoly.
Unfortunately, the ACC has Miami and Florida State, and SEC has University of Florida.
Could we see a playoff where every team is from the SEC?
I don't think you could, no. But you will see a disproportionate number of teams, which, again, you guys talked about yesterday. This does open up the chance that a 3-loss team can make it, right? If you get to 12.
Yes.
And these things, again, are intertwined. So you're going to see the playoff happen sooner rather than later with more teams.
Is this all the instigation of ESPN? Is this all your fault?
I'd like to take the fifth. Do I have rights? I don't know whether my rights apply here on freedom.
Just say you got hacked, John.
Okay, say I got hacked.
Yes.
Okay.
Score major comfort with the new Hanes Originals Super Soft Styles. Imagine this: fabric so soft it feels like you're practically wearing nothing. Now that's next level softness. Whether you're storming the court, conquering the workday, or just chilling on the couch, Hanes Original Super Soft Styles have you covered, literally, in soft, cooling comfort. And let's not forget the style. These sleek designs and colors won't just keep you feeling great, they'll have you looking like a champion. So ditch the discomfort and upgrade your game with the new Hanes Original Super Soft Styles. They're soft, they're cooling, they're everything. Try Hanes' softest fabric ever at hanes.com/originals. Use discount code DANLB20.
Don Levitard.
Greg Cody of the Miami Herald, who is a source of constant frustration and entitlement and narcissism. This is what he says. This is either the last Back in My Day as a regular series or the first of a new phase in which Back in My Days are occasional, not every week. So he has just announced officially his laziness.
Stugatz.
I want to make him an occasional series.
I am once a week.
But no, I think more occasional. Right. I think every time you don't have a Back in My Day, you can't do the show.
Okay, that's fine, because I have a contract. So if you want to pay me for not doing the show.
That's fine. We can pay him for doing nothing. We already do.
That's a good one. I got no retort for that.
This is the Don Levitard Show with the Stugatz.
This story that Amin has been trying to get my attention now on is something that is in full bloom at the Olympics, because I can't believe that what I'm reading is so. I would have thought that this was something from The Onion. So I'm just going to read it, Stugatz, because it seems crazy. 10 days after fencer Alan Hadzik secured a spot as an alternate on the U.S. Olympic team, a group of women took their concerns about him straight to the top. The six women fencers, including two Olympic athletes, wrote to the Olympic Committee that Hadzik should not be allowed to represent the U.S. because he was under investigation for at least three accusations of sexual misconduct reported to the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, the nonprofit agency responsible for protecting athletes from abuse. Acknowledging the severity of the allegations facing Hadzik, USA Fencing, the athletic federation in charge of selecting the country's Olympic competitors, created a safety plan to keep him away from women and out of the Olympic Village. He flew in on a separate plane from his teammates, is staying at a hotel 30 minutes away from the other athletes, and won't be allowed to practice alongside women teammates. After he appealed those conditions, the entire roster of Team USA fencers signed a letter demanding the restrictions stay in place. To many of his teammates, he shouldn't be representing the country at all. Quote, "We are pissed off that this is even a thing we have to deal with." An Olympic fencer who filed a complaint against Hadzik alleging predatory behavior told BuzzFeed News from Tokyo, "He's been protected again and again." How does this happen? How can it be possible that a fencing alternate is worth all of these liberties and rule changes just for him? How can someone
about alternate? If he was the greatest fencer in the history of fencing, he should not be representing a country. He should not be allowed. He should not be allowed at the Olympic Games. I mean, I'm with you. It's perplexing how this happens.
How does a team tell you we can't have this guy on representing our country on our team? And the reaction to that is to protect him, is to protect his spot on the team, is to make so many concessions that the way that you protect the women is by making all sorts of different rules that make it so that he can be on the team. The reason that I said an alternate is because I'd understand compromised principles at the height of sports where people are always making these decisions. In the business of sports, they're throwing away their principles and their moralities all the time because so-and-so is so great that we can't do without him. But how do you arrive in a place where on fencing with an alternate, you're changing all the rules when the people are telling you that are on the team, get him away from us?
A lot of people also are making the parallel that Sha'Carri Richardson was not allowed to go to Tokyo because she failed a drug test. And in the meantime, marijuana test, which we obviously is legal in a lot of places in the United States and most people don't consider a very big deal anymore. And in the meantime, this person is given all of these special circumstances just so he can go despite these accusations. And in the BuzzFeed news stories, there's also some accusations of him having violent behavior while he's drinking. There's an accusation that he kicked an unhoused person on the street and just walked past someone and kicked them once. It's pretty damning stuff. And the ability for the sport to make all of these concessions for him while the rules are just not equal for everyone is kind of glaring in this case.
I don't even know if we had someone on from USA Fencing, how it is that given the details that I'm reading, I don't even know how you make the argument on behalf of allowing this person to get a totally different set of rules because he's so important to what you're doing that you have to offend everybody on your team in order to do it.
They're trying to limit the public shaming, too, because they posted a photo of him on social media and limited the comments after fencers were actually having to go in the comments trying to highlight that this person being there is beyond problematic.
Doesn't the head of U.S. fencing have to lose his or her job over this? I mean, it's not a bigger scandal because it's fencing.
No, Dan, you do question the people making these decisions.
Doesn't he have to lose his job over this?
Yes, fencing, entirely. That goes without saying. But the person that allowed this fencer to be at the Olympic Games representing our country, despite hearing all the negative things from teammates who would know more than they would know, I mean, Dan, that's concerning that people are in that position making those types of decisions. It is.
From what I understand, USA Fencing did disqualify him, but then he went to arbitration and the arbitrator reinstated him. He won his case in arbitration.
So. Okay, so they went through some sort of process and then they're legally bound somehow so that they don't get lawsuits. Okay, then at least you're giving me some information that presents another side of this argument, because the details that I have so far don't help me at all to understand that if they're legally bound somehow because now they're going to get lawsuits keeping somebody off of a team, that would better explain why you would go to these lengths to make any sort of concessions for anybody, never mind an alternate.
And the BuzzFeed News story goes into some detail about SafeSport, which is this governing body that was created, I believe, as a result of the Larry Nassar trial, that is now in charge of governing cases of sexual misconduct and sexual abuse within sport in America. So I believe they are the ones who are being called into question for the way that they are handling this case.
Expressing your love can look many different ways. And with the right jewelry gift from Blue Nile, it can truly sparkle. Blue Nile's collection of classic diamond jewelry makes for the kind of gift that speaks volumes without saying a single word. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, Blue Nile's diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Don Levitard.
I don't want your beak leaning over the plate.
Stugatz.
Step back, Jack.
This is the Don Levitard Show with the Stugatz.
All right, let's take a minute for my friends here at DraftKings. We love DraftKings. DraftKings Sportsbook is not only my favorite sportsbook, but also America's top-rated sportsbook. How about that? I love it, and America loves it as well. Speaking of America, our top athletes are over in Tokyo competing for the gold, and DraftKings has a medal-worthy offer just for our listeners. Listen to this great offer. Place any pre-event wager of $1 to be eligible to cash $100 in free credits if America wins any medal this year. That's 100-1 odds on an American athlete to stand on the podium and receive gold, silver, or bronze this week. It seems like a lock to me. 100-1 odds is an offer that doesn't come around often, so sign up today at DraftKings Sportsbook. Do it right now to get in on all the action. I love using DraftKings Sportsbook. It's easy to navigate, has plenty of instructions for new bettors, and nearly limitless ways to get in on all the action. My friends and family have been loving DraftKings Sportsbook, and I know you will too. Download the top-rated DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code DAN when you sign up to turn $1 into $100 of free credits if America wins a medal. That's it. That's all it takes. That's code DAN to turn $1 into $100 in free credits for a limited time only at DraftKings Sportsbook.
Hello, Miren.
Hey, guys.
Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for asking me. This is cool.
Good timing on a book.
Yeah.
I mean,
we were talking before you jumped on. She wrote a book about Giannis. It was due on March the 1st. And she turned it in only for Giannis to then go win the NBA title. Fortuitous publishing of a book, I would say.
Congratulations.
And now my friends think I am a witch, so.
Well, we should start there without introduction. I hope that they air all of that, because if you're not familiar with her work, she writes about people who happen to play sports, but she's interested in telling human stories. And her new book, Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP, is out August 10th. Thank you for joining us. What would you say were the things that you learned that you did not know that you found most interesting about a guy that I don't feel like we know very well? I feel like we've just got some superficial glances about him being humble and being some of the things that people like about athletes, but you've got the entire biography, the entire journey.
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me. I feel like the entire childhood section is stuff that I didn't know, you know, and that was the goal for me. It was like, how can I bridge the gap between sold trinkets on the street and becomes an NBA MVP? We really don't know too much in between. Where did he sell trinkets? How did he sell trinkets? You know, who bought it? What kind of food would they eat? Like, there were just thousands of questions that I had. And what I found was that yes, there are feel-good elements that a lot of people have picked up. You know, it's called a fairy tale. But there are also people that were not kind to him at all. There was so much racism that he dealt with. And being undocumented as a Black child of migrants was very, very hard. And I think that gets swept under the rug with Giannis because people love to talk about his ascension. And then finally, just there was joy. You know, a lot of times us in media, we write about the trauma of athletes and we don't talk about the good times and the happy times that they had. But he had a lot of joy because for him, his childhood was normal. You know, it wasn't this sob story all of the time. He had a lot of fun. So it was really interesting for me to see that childhood part of his life.
What are the things that you say from his childhood are most responsible for shaping who he is as an adult?
I think, first of all, it was observing. Giannis is a very intellectual and curious person, and is because he would always watch what his parents did. So when his mom would work 14-hour days and come home tired, but have this giant smile on her face, he could intuit that she was not happy, but she was trying to be so that he would have happy memories. And she would force herself to wash, for example, their socks. They each only had one pair. And he watches that and he's like, that is work ethic. You know, nobody has to tell him work hard. He learns it from watching. He learns it from seeing that his dad is sitting there smiling, even though he's hungry and hasn't eaten in 2 days, because his dad wants to, you know, give the portion to Giannis and his brothers. And then I think finally, Giannis is 13 years old, feeling like the man of his brothers. He is watching where his younger brothers go and always having to be careful and, you know, don't go there, or, you know, oh, you can have my food. He almost has to mature so much more quickly than other boys.
What were the hard parts about the transition to America?
That was one of the most interesting things I found. So I think if you all remember in 2013 to 14, when he's a rookie, everyone's falling in love with Giannis, right? He's drinking smoothies. We're all like, wow, who is this adorable Greek kid? He was deeply, deeply lonely. And Alex, the youngest brother, was telling me that Giannis almost left the NBA. He was telling Alex and the family, like, if you guys can't come here to America, I'm coming home. So for a backstory, Giannis and his brother, Thanasis, got citizenship at the last minute by the Greek government, because unlike in America, Greece doesn't give you birthright citizenship, even if you're born there. So once the Greek government saw that Giannis was about to go to the NBA, they gave him his papers, but they didn't give it to his mom, they didn't give it to his dad, and they didn't give it to the younger brothers. So they got their visas denied 2 times, I found in my reporting, while Giannis made it to the NBA. And it was doubtful whether they were going to be able to move to America. And Giannis is somebody that's so used to sleeping side by side with his brothers, you know, being around his family every second. And without them, he just felt lost. You know, he was trying to do well on the court. Milwaukee was terrible. They won 15 games that year, but he was just so, so lonely without his family.
Why is he so hard on himself?
He's so hard on himself because he knows the chances that people get are so slim. There was one moment where he and his brothers had a chance to move up to a better division in Greece because they were in the lowest division, which is called A2. But at the end of the year, if you win your last game, you can leapfrog to the top one. And had they leapfrogged, they would have gotten money. They would have gotten shoes. It would have changed their family's life. And they lost. And so it's moments like that where they're all sitting together after this game and just crying, watching opportunity slip from their fingers. And they realize that the chances that people get do not come often. And when they come, you have to get them, or else you never know when they'll come again. So Giannis grew up with this sense of being so hard on himself, dealing with factors that he can't control. And there's also a burning desire in him to be great. He has always wanted to be great. Like, he comes to America, Milwaukee, doesn't even know how to weightlift, but he wants to become the best weightlifter on the Milwaukee Bucks. So imagine learning to bench press for the first time, and you're already thinking about how can I outdo people? And then when you don't outdo people, and you're a scrub, and you're scrawny, and you are not the best, you are actually the worst on the team, that motivates him, and he's tough on himself. One of my favorite things I'll just say to end here on this answer is that I learned that he's so hard on himself that he would cry openly growing up in Greece. So there, boys are socialized differently. You don't have to hold in your emotions like we do in America. And his coaches became used to it. Oh, Giannis is upset with his performance. He's crying on the bench. So when he comes to Milwaukee, there are moments where Larry Drew, the coach, and Robert Hackett, the strength coach, told me they would watch him tear up when he wasn't doing well. And they had to tell him, like, you can't cry in the NBA. So I think Giannis just has a different level of emotional intelligence and sensitivity that really drives him.
That desire to be great, where did that come from?
You know, I think some of it's innate. Some of it is from his dad. So his dad was, Charles is a former soccer player. And Charles would always say, you know, you must give everything when you're playing. And they were just playing pickup soccer. You know, Charles is 40 something. They're beating all the people in Sampolia. But there was a sense that even if you're having fun, you want to work your hardest and try to be the best. And so he's just always had that.
How cautious was he about spending once he got to money?
Oh my God, that was one of the biggest things I found. Giannis is so hesitant. So, you know, as a child, he's so used to suppressing his wants because he knows that the only thing that matters are needs. And as a child, he wanted a PlayStation so badly and they just couldn't get it. So by the time he gets to Milwaukee and he has money, he sees one and he is so interested in buying it. And he does it on whim. And then he berates himself for being so frivolous. You know, how can you do this when people back home are suffering? How can you do this? And he returns it the next morning. I mean, he was the only player I found in my reporting that didn't have direct deposit because he needed to feel the money in his hands. He wouldn't spend a dime. He saved everything for his family to come over. His home was almost like the preparation home. We're going to have all the per diems over here for my family once they come. I'm not even going to mess up this bed. I'm going to keep it immaculate for them. Like, he was so hesitant. And you know what? It continued on even when he became a multimillionaire. I think the first time he bought first class seats was like 2016.
How close in your reporting did you get to his decision making on whether to stay in Milwaukee or leave?
You know, not directly to him, because at that point, COVID had hit and all my in-person stuff fizzled. But I was hearing a lot about, like, his mom, Veronica, and knowing that, you know, she really loves staying. But I was kind of hearing both things, you know. I kind of thought it could go both ways. Like, it is entirely possible that he could leave. Like, some days he seems like he's in it and he wants to stay. And other days it's like, I don't know. But for me, the thing that stood out from the reporting that I did prior to that summer, when I did the story for Bleacher Report, which this came out of, where I spent the day with them, I was just amazed how rooted they were in Milwaukee, how much they saw it as home. Because, you know, they've moved so much geographically. Like Alex, the youngest brother, like, he made a life there. He had friends there. They really loved Milwaukee. So I could kind of have seen it going either way.
You say that you had a million questions about how he grew up and where did he sell trinkets and what trinkets was he selling. What are the reported details that stayed with you the most? You mentioned owning one pair of socks. The things that you didn't know that you discovered that you found most detail rich were?
Yeah, so they would go to upscale beaches that were far away. One of them is called Alamos Beach. And you would think, like, in your mind that this is a negative experience, they're selling off the side of the street. But actually, the boys loved going to the beach because they could go in the water and have fun. And for a moment, they would be distracted from all of the painful things going on. And they were just learning to swim and laughing and having fun. And so they would be gone for 2 weeks at a time at these upscale beaches. And they had to be so creative with what they sold. They would find, like, a knockoff Louis Vuitton purse and then sell it. They would just find little tiny things like that. And also, I found that it was risky to sell because they didn't have a permit. So the market is called the Laiki, and it was on Wednesdays. And they could get in trouble for being there because they did not have one of those stands or a permit like most people, because they were undocumented. So just finding out that, you know, Thanasis would brag to people like, I can run really fast. If the cops find us or whatever, I can get away. You know, just details like that. And details like, one anecdote really stood out. Giannis didn't really want to let his teammates know how much they were suffering or didn't have. And so they didn't really know the extent of their suffering until Giannis fainted one practice because he hadn't eaten anything all day. and talking to the coaches and teammates who just felt so bad, like, you know, we didn't know. We had no idea, because he wasn't one to be like, can you help me? You know, he wanted to try to handle it on his own. You know, there were just so many anecdotes like that. And for example, one teammate who's a good friend of Giannis to this day, his name is Christos Salustros. He would give the brothers money to get a Gatorade or something at the market. And the little brothers, Kostas and Alex, were so touched by this, they insisted on bringing back change and the receipt. And the friend was like, no, you don't worry about it. But they felt so bad that people were giving to them. And so, you know, you just saw the kindness of so many people.
Knowing him the way you know him now, I'm wondering, did anything about his emotional outburst, how talkative he was, how happy he was after winning the title, did any of that surprise you?
It didn't surprise me. In fact, when I saw him sitting and crying, I thought of the 12-year-old who would cry openly. I thought of the 18-year-old who would cry on the bench in Milwaukee because he was dissatisfied with his performance. I thought it was such a beautiful display of emotion that we don't always see from our modern day superstars. And it just reminded me how different Giannis is wired and how unique he is in so many ways. And I know that winning, it wasn't just look at all that I personally have overcome. It was look at all of Milwaukee has overcome. You know, a big part of the book was charting the history of the Bucks and how from its inception, people were like, basketball can't work in Milwaukee. You have this like decades old wound of Kareem leaving, and Giannis like heals this wound by staying. And if he doesn't stay, the franchise doesn't stay. And so I saw the tears, and I just, all these, I was making all these connections between all these crazy things that have happened, all because of this guy.
You mentioned the smoothies. I remember the way I was introduced to him was early in his career, somebody filmed him running to either the game or practice where he was just, I don't even know, running miles to where it is that he wasn't driving a car. He was just running there.
The anecdote is actually that he was running to a Western, so he went to a Western Union to send all the money he had to home to Greece, and he realized he put all of his money into the Western Union and didn't have money for a cab home, so he just started running.
Yes, and I talked to the woman who picked him up that day. Her name is Jane Gallup, longtime Bucks fan. The Bucks were like the one thing she had in common with her son. And she sees this tall guy running. She's like, why do I know him? You know, why does he look familiar? And then she's like, oh, shit, it's Giannis. And then just instinctually, her Midwestern maternal self is like, should we like ask him if he needs help? And then they pull down the window and Giannis is like, can you take me to the Bradley Center? And then like he thinks they're a taxi. You know what I mean? And Jane is like, oh, yeah, sure. So I forgot the details in the book, but it's it might have been a Honda Fit, a very like petite car. And so Giannis stuffs his like gangly self in the back seat. He's just looking nervous. His knees are up to his nose. You know, and this is the weirdest situation. Jane is like, I don't understand why he has a windbreaker. We're in Milwaukee. She's debating if she should take him to a Walmart to buy him a coat. Giannis is just sitting back there like quiet. It's the most awkward car ride ever. But afterward, you know, he gets out and he's like, thank you very much. I really, really appreciate it. And he gives his autograph in Greek and English. And then John Hammond, the Bucks GM, is like, Giannis, don't ever get in the car with strangers. You know, it's just this adorable, like a paternal thing, you know, but that's how it was back then with Giannis. They were looking after him like he was their son.
What are the other details from the cultural transition, the isolation and the stuff that the details that stuck out to you about when you're talking about he almost left the NBA? I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. So first of all, the sense of physically being so lonely. So one of my favorite scenes in the book is he becomes really close to this video coordinator for the Bucks named Ross Geiger. And it's really late after the game. And the two of them became besties. They would always go to Chili's because Chili's had, you know, late night specials and Giannis liked how cheap it was, of course. Or they would go to Cheesecake Factory because Giannis became obsessed with burgers and milkshakes. Like he could not get over this concept of a milkshake, not quite ice cream, not quite smoothie. You know, what a combination. And they get back to Giannis's apartment and Ross is like, hey, buddy, I got to go. We got practice early. I got to break down this film. And Giannis is like so vulnerable in this moment. He's like, can you like stay the night? you know, and it was just so like, my heart is just, you know, it's just so tender because it's like, he was so alone and he just needed somebody to be there. And then Ross stays and Ross realizes he gets the trust of Giannis because Giannis doesn't trust people because he grows up being undocumented, not knowing who could hurt them or take his parents away. And the other anecdote that really stood out to me, might be my favorite one in the book that I found, is that because he was so distrustful, he wanted a Buck staffer present when he got his cable installed. And because he didn't know, like, who is this guy coming to my apartment? A Bucks guy is there. It goes on a really long time, like 9 to 4. And the Bucks staffer is hungry. So he goes into Giannis's kitchen and he takes 3 Oreos. He sees a little Oreo jar. Doesn't think anything of it. He just eats it, whatever. The next day at practice, Giannis is like kind of mad. He goes up to the staffer. He's like, did you eat my Oreos? And then the staffer's like, what do you mean? You know? And then Giannis is like, well, I noticed 3 were missing. And the staffer is just stunned because, first of all, like, who does that? Who counts their Oreos? But then it all makes sense to him. Of course he counts his Oreos. This is a person that is so used to being without. He always has to know how much he has. And so it's just moments like that where people really saw that he was dealing with so much more than trying to be a good basketball player. He was really trying to reconcile all of his childhood trauma and trying to adapt, but not being able to let go of these impulses.
The name of the book, Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP, is out August 10th. Thank you for the insight. I did not know a good deal of that stuff. Appreciate you sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.